the law is ultimately for people without power, because people with power don't need the laws to oppress you, right?
Hello, and welcome to Marching On, the podcast brought to you by the ACLU of Kansas. I'm Esme Tseng, Communications Director, and I thank you for joining us. It's no secret that our criminal legal system is disproportionately tough on poor people. Adults in poverty are more likely to be arrested, charged with a felony, detained for longer periods, and punished more severely. Once someone enters the criminal legal system, they are subjected to all kinds of fees and expenses, and failure to pay these often results in even more expenses and more punishment, ensnaring poor people in an often inescapable legal abyss. On this episode, we talk with two experts who are working against this force. The first is our very own legal director, Monica Bennett, who joins us to share an overview of our recent lawsuit, England v. Kansas, challenging current practices that extend probation based on failure to pay, all the while denying them basic rights like the freedom of movement and their right to vote. After that, we connect with Sam Allison Natale, executive director of the Kansas Holistic Defenders. Sam sheds light on the holistic model of legal defense, which advocates beyond the boundaries of an individual's single legal case to integrating more comprehensive solutions that meaningfully change the lives of people caught in the criminal legal system. It's a really fascinating discussion that rethinks the way we think about not only criminal defense, but community defense. The interview with Sam is in the second part of the show. So first, we'll start with my insightful conversation with Monica. I'm here with Monica Bennett, ACLU of Kansas legal director, to discuss our lawsuit, England v. Kansas, which we filed in October in the Federal District Court of Kansas. We are challenging the probation practices in Johnson County that unjustly and unconstitutionally punish the poor and undermine their freedoms, including the right to vote. So, Monica, can you summarize the claims that we make in the case and the resolution that our clients are hoping for?
Sure. I think it might help to sort of give a little bit of background as to why we brought the case, so what the facts were that led to our claims. You spoke correctly in saying that we believe that the probation system that's in place punishes the poor, but specifically we're talking about probation that's based upon outstanding restitution. So when an individual is convicted of or pleads guilty to a crime that involves usually some sort of money. It could be passing bad checks. It could be some sort of identity theft. There might be a monetary component to that. And so when they are sentenced, the court requires them to pay restitution. The way that Kansas law is set up is that if you are sentenced to probation and restitution is a part of your court order, that your probation can be extended for it as long as you still owe any outstanding restitution amount. And that was what was happening with our clients, and it happens with hundreds of people at least across the state of Kansas. So we brought this suit because when our clients and when others go before the court and they're on probation and they still owe restitution, the court's never making an inquiry about whether or not they can actually afford to pay the outstanding restitution. Not only that, but when you're on probation, you lose several freedoms, things that most of us take for granted, being able to go to any restaurant that you'd like to go to, being able to go and visit with your family if they live out of state, because of some of the conditions of probation. And so the claims that we make in the case have to do with those sorts of deprivations. The fact that people are deprived of their Fourth Amendment right to privacy, right, to be free from searches and seizures because they have to continue to submit to random drug testing. And in a lot of cases, substance abuse was not a part of the crime that they were convicted of. They're not allowed the right to travel without getting permission from the court before leaving the state of Kansas. And that's true even if they live in Johnson County and they want to travel to Kansas City Missouri.
Oh, wow.
We have a plaintiff who lives in Jackson County, and she has doctor's appointments sometimes in Johnson County, and she has to get permission from the court before she can do that. People who are on probation and have been convicted of felonies can't vote. And that's really central to being a part of our democratic system and a part of making even the system that they're being subjected to better, that they don't have a voice in it.
And so individuals who are having to get permission from the court in Johnson County from to Jackson County, that's the Kansas City area, right? A lot of us come and go frequently. Is that every time that she has to go to an appointment, she's having to ask for that permission?
Technically, yes. Well, right? Technically, yes. Yeah.
And so what, I mean, you've touched on 4th and 14th Amendment violations here. What does relief look like for the clients?
Yeah, well, first we'd like to see due process happening. Right. That's the 14th Amendment you're talking about there, where people are going to court and there's a process in place by which the court can determine whether they're able to pay. Because if they're not, then they're being punished for their poverty. So that's one thing that we'd like to see happen. And I mean, ultimately, what I would like to see, and we'll see whether or not we can convince a court that this would be appropriate, but that people would not be subjected to the conditions of probation, like the inability to vote, the inability to go to an establishment where any alcohol is served, having to submit to random drug testing and all the other things that deprive a person of their right to move about as a free citizen just because they owe restitution. There are other ways of collecting outstanding debt. We're all familiar with how debt can be collected, and it can be done without telling someone that they can't vote or that they can't go visit their mother in another state.
So you touched on it a little bit in the beginning, but I thought it would be helpful to drill down. You talk about the extension of folks' probation due to failure to pay. How far are we talking about here? How much is their probation being extended?
Like, as a baseline matter, I think it's helpful to realize that the statute allows for probation to be extended indefinitely.
Wow.
Now, when a person goes to court for a revocation hearing, which is often how those hearings are titled, or when they sign a voluntary, and I'm putting voluntary in air quotes for anybody who can't see me, extension of probation, it's typically, we're looking at maybe it's 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. Though recently, we've seen 5 years. Our clients most recently have had to extend for 5 years. But that can go on and on and on, such that you have people who have been on probation for literally decades.
And at these hearings, they're sort of entitled to have their whole situation reviewed, and it sounds like this review is not necessarily occurring.
They are at least entitled to be heard on their ability to pay. So Kansas statutes refer to something called workability of restitution, and that's talking about whether or not restitution, the person has the means to pay.
So these are some really harmful restrictions, right? These are fundamental freedoms that restrict your physical ability to come and go. And then obviously, we're at the ACLU of Kansas, we're very concerned with people's access to be able to vote. Can you maybe share a little bit more about how this has affected our individual clients and why it's been so harmful for them?
Sure. So one, there's a stigma attached to being on probation. So even if there were not these restrictions that we're talking about, there is a stigma to being on probation. When people go to apply for jobs, when people go to apply for housing, it's something that can influence the decision. It can influence them in that way. But in other very real, like, day-to-day matters, being on probation with these conditions can influence you. Many of our clients have children, but one in particular has a daughter, and she described an instance where her daughter was invited to a party at Chuck E. Cheese. Well, apparently some Chuck E. Cheese's now serve alcoholic beverages. The conditions of her probation and the conditions of many people's probation state that they cannot visit any establishment that serves alcohol for consumption on the premises. You know, you can't go to Red Lobster, you can't go to most places. Mm-hmm. Just with that, conditions of probation also say that a person is not to associate with anyone else who's been convicted of a crime. One, how do you know that? How do you know? Yeah, right? You have to go to your workplace. You don't know what people's situations are, but people can be not forthcoming. People can be not forthcoming. And also, what purpose does that serve? People have, being convicted of a crime is a really broad idea, right? And so First Amendment says we have the freedom of association. But here we are telling people that because you still owe restitutions, you can't associate with people that you choose to associate with.
With any crime.
Yeah.
That's wild. So, yeah, I think this is a really good overview of the modern impact, I think, and obviously the constitutional claims and a really good summary of how it's affected them in a daily way. How should we understand these really punitive practices in a historical context and sort of the fundamental freedoms and the political and social impacts? What is the context we should understand?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some people are familiar with it. Maybe not many of us are familiar with something called Black Codes. So the Black Codes were a series of laws that many slaveholding states and some non-slaveholding states passed after the 13th Amendment, after the Emancipation Proclamation, when enslaved people were going to be free. And the Black Codes say things like, Black men and women are not free to associate in groups. Black men and women are not allowed to sell or consume alcohol. In fact, it was criminal in some states for a white person to sell alcohol to a Black person. Black people were not allowed to own any weapons. So when we look at things like restrictions on movement, directly related to the Black Codes and things that happened after the Civil War, right? The right to travel, which is a fundamental right under the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court has said as much. And so if you hold the probation code in Kansas and in other places, but in Kansas, up to a list of Black Codes, the similarities are remarkable. They are, in fact, if I asked you to tell me if a certain restriction came from one or the other, you'd have to raise your hand for both. It is remarkable. And so historically, certain segments of society have been limited in their freedoms. They've been treated as second-class citizens. And things like the Black Codes, Jim Crow, all those things were set up to keep people as second-class citizens. And when we look at the probation statutes and we hear things like a person can't go to a restaurant of their choosing, they can't associate with other people, they can't vote. The fact that people can't vote should automatically make all of us think about second-class citizenry. And so that's, in a historical context, how we see the similarities there.
That's a really helpful summary, I think, especially for folks maybe who don't understand that even in the free state in Kansas, the Black Codes and the legacy are affecting people every day, right?
I want to touch on what you just said about even in the free state of Kansas, because we are the free state. That is the name, right? But the seminal case that had to do with separate, not being equal, is Brown v. Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas. And so that was here in our free state. We should not think that we are so different from places where we think that segregation was happening.
Yeah, there's a temptation to flatten the nuance in our history, especially our racial history.
Yeah.
Well, that's really helpful context. How should we understand the trajectory of the case now? What's ahead?
So we're still in the early stages. We've filed a complaint. That's why we're here talking about it today. And we have responded to motions to dismiss that the defendants file. And right now we're waiting for the court to rule. So we'll know how we're going to move forward. So if the court rules in our favor, and we hope they will, they won't dismiss the case and we'll move on to the next phases of litigation, discovery, having more discussions with the defendants. If the court doesn't rule in our favor and does dismiss the case, then we'll be thinking about where do we go next as far as appeals and that sort of thing. And we'll have conversations with our clients, of course, but we think we've got a good case here, and we think that the laws that we are challenging infringe upon the rights of so many candidates in so many ways that are unconstitutional that we believe it's a case worth continuing to fight.
I completely agree, and I'm so glad that you're here doing that work with us. Thank you so much to Monica for joining us and for your work on this really important issue. Now we go to our interview with Sam Allison Natale, Executive Director of the Kansas Holistic Defenders, in conversation with our own communications manager, Jesse Keelman.
So I am here with Sam, Founder and Executive Director of the Kansas Holistic Defenders. I thought I would just start with giving you a chance to introduce yourself, just a little bit of the journey that brought you here.
Sure. So my name is Sam Allison Natale. I'm the Executive Director of Kansas Holistic Defenders. I moved to Kansas, 7 years ago, which is crazy because it is coming up on the longest that I've lived anywhere. And before I moved to Kansas, I was in New York, and I was working as an attorney at the Bronx Defenders. I think my journey started towards public defense very early. Both my parents are public defenders. Yeah, they tried very hard to talk me out of this. They're like, why don't you do something easy that makes a bunch of money? They're very proud of me. And they actually met at a public defender training conference called the National Criminal Defense College.
That's super cute, too.
From both of them, I got some values that put me on this trajectory, even as they were trying to talk me out of it. Both of them have this really deep well of compassion for our clients and for working class people. I moved to New York straight out of college and was working at a law firm as a researcher. And then Occupy Wall Street happened, and which will tell you exactly how old I am. And now, you know, I grew up in a very racially and economically segregated place. You know, you have West Palm Beach, which is the mainland across the water from Palm Beach, the island with all the billionaires. And then 1 mile inland with some of the poorest Black American communities in the United States. And so I grew up literally in between this insane wealth divide. And so I had experiences both through my parents, but also growing up of seeing Palm Beach police arrest people just for being Black. So when Occupy happened, it was transformative because all of a sudden, there were hundreds of thousands and millions of people who cared about the things that I cared about. And so I thought, okay, it's movement time. And at that time, I thought the best way that I could serve the movement was to become a lawyer. So I applied for just one law school. I was NYU Law, and I went there. And it was sort of a unique place because there was so many people who wanted to go into public interest law. And so I was surrounded by people who wanted to be public defenders. I then became one, and I got a job at the Bronx Defenders, which had pioneered this holistic model of public defense. And each team was interdisciplinary. So we had criminal attorneys and family defense attorneys and social workers and client advocates and immigration attorneys and civil attorneys and housing attorneys all working together on this big team so that when one of my clients had an immigration issue come up as part of their case, I didn't need to leave the building. I walked two desks down to Lauren Migliaccio's desk, and she was able to help my client with what they needed. And that was just the standard. It was also a place that had a deep belief in fighting like hell for our clients. And when I was in New York, I met my partner, and they had got me into organizing. And I started getting involved in organizing primarily around immigrant defense because, you know, especially in your first year as a public defender, you're like, I got in here to change things and to end mass incarceration. And then you are getting people out of this meat grinder one at a time. But there's always somehow new coming in. And this is where I learned that, like, just being an attorney was not enough. We needed to, politics is millions, right? And it's, we need to be deeply in movement with the people who also have an interest and often a far more direct interest in changing the state of affairs. So I learned to organize and got involved in organizing and was involved in, like, we did walkouts of the courthouse when ICE would come and grab our clients. And when my partner said that they were going to move to Kansas and that this was a really strategically important place for us to be doing movement work, I said, sure.
That's what inspired the move. I was like, yeah, those guys, purely love. No other location. Nope.
Yeah, when I moved here, I was like, oh, no problem. I'll be a public defender. And I couldn't because there wasn't one in Douglas County. And at that time, the state public defender's office was largely on fire. So this was like 2018, the year that one in four public defenders in Kansas quit.
I didn't realize that. Can you share a little more about
it? Yeah, I mean, it was decades of underfunding by the state legislature and leadership that was not ready to fight. And around that same time, Heather Cessna became the executive director of the State Board of Indigent Defense Services and has done marvelous things in the 8 years that I've been here to improve the public defense system. Ann Sagan is now the director, who is doing phenomenal things. And I was steered by Melody Brannon, who is the head of the Federal Defenders, to work for a private attorney named Tom Bath. So I worked for him in private practice, which was great in some ways, right? But this was not what I dedicated my life to. Already in Lawrence, by the time we moved here, one of the biggest issues in local politics was the opposition to the jail expansion. So the county wanted to spend $30 million on a bigger jail and a coalition of leftists and progressives and libertarians and old church ladies.
Diverse.
Yes, yes. This is also 2020, like the high watermark of public consciousness and demands for improvements to the criminal justice system. And so the low-hanging fruit of, okay, we got a jail with too many people in it. How do we stop there from being too many people in the jail was fixing the gap in having an institutional public defender that could be there when the decision to put the person in jail on bond was first being made, which is something that the previous system of panel attorneys was not able to do. So we were awarded a contract by Douglas County to represent people charged with misdemeanors starting before their first appearance. We've been doing that ever since, and we also expanded to do eviction defense, benefits denials appeals, and now we're doing felony appointments as well. And so we've pretty much doubled in size since we first got started.
That's an exciting milestone to get to, too. I'm curious if you could maybe step back a little bit and share a little bit more about what holistic defense means. And I'm curious too, because you mentioned that being so integral to some of like your experiences in New York and bringing that here as well. So I'm curious how that all kind of interplays.
So the holistic model of public defense was really pioneered by Neighborhood Defender Services, Harlem, and the Bronx Defenders. And this model involved expanding the very narrow confines of the tradition of public defense. So if you go back to the earliest iterations of public defense, they were not government institutions. The earliest public defenders was Legal Aid Organization of New York, which was a mutual aid legal effort put together by immigrants who needed to protect their communities. And so that was the first time that there was legal aid provided to people who were unable to afford an attorney. That idea took root and communities all over the United States organized around this demand of it is unfair to put people through the punishment system without having an attorney. And actually starting in the West Coast, the first government-sponsored public defense office was in Los Angeles, founded by a female attorney, actually, also breaking ground at the start of the 20th century. But as governments began to recognize the right to public defense, they were recognizing it in the context of a country that is very eager to constrain what people are led to believe that they are entitled to by a government. So by the time that Gideon versus Wainwright came down in the 1960s, most states had already recognized a right to public defense. So the Supreme Court had to deal with the issue of do people have a right, an affirmative right, under the Constitution to a service by lawyers. And there are very few instances of positive rights that the government has ever recognized in the Constitution. One of the other important ones here, Kansas being the right to education in the Kansas Constitution in the Gannon decision. But the reason that the court was sort of motivated to this was because the United States was in a global competition for legitimacy, specifically against communist countries that recognized a far greater range of affirmative government provision and rights. One thing we had going was that our criminal legal system was marginally better than the system of gulags and show trials. And so the Supreme Court was ultimately persuaded to recognize this affirmative right, but moved very quickly in a series of subsequent decisions to say, no, it is just for a criminal case, right? And maybe a couple of other things. If they're taking your kid away, you get an attorney, right? And you may have some rights to due process, but not an attorney. And so for many government-created public defenders, especially as opposed to some of the earlier or community-driven efforts, largely just focused on the criminal case. And so that when the Bronx Defenders and Neighborhood Defender Services of Harlem came up as community-led responses to the limitations of then existing legal defense, there was an opportunity to expand. And what they did is what we have done is simply follow their clients into the courtrooms where they were being threatened. And so this meant that, sure, you may have a misdemeanor and it's not a big deal and we can fight that and we can win on that. But if because of the misdemeanor, there is now a child protective services case that is going to split your family in half, that's actually where you need the attorney, right?
Okay.
And so these criminal attorneys started getting involved in family court cases and started getting involved in their clients' evictions and started adding on services to help not only deal with the criminal case or even these other legal issues, but the areas outside of their lives that were being impacted. The other factor here in the development was the existence of private philanthropy and of grants that, you know, this holistic model of public defense had to be cut out from more than just government contracts. And, you know, another amazing thing that the Bronx Defenders was able to do was bring in other sources of community and philanthropic funding and donor funding to be able to address these needs that our clients had. And so in New York, you know, by the time that I was there, I was a cog in a well-oiled machine, right? Everything just worked really well. And New York has a social safety net that is somewhat functional. There are shelters and you have a right to shelter. It's just that there are barriers and navigating it and there's the bureaucracy you have to go through. But at the end of that bureaucracy, there was a place, a warm, sheltered place to stay. The same for mental health services, the same for many of the things that our clients needed. It was simply a matter of advocating and navigating and supporting them to those. And what we had found as the difficulty of implementing the holistic model here at Kansas is that there is not that social safety net. We and others in this community are knitting a social safety net together out of the twigs and leaves of what exists. And
that sounds like Kansas.
Yeah. I do want to address one thing, which is a question you didn't ask, which is, you know, why have we oriented our services in the way that we have now to really focus on criminal defense and evictions?
Yeah.
And part of the reason is, you know, in the earliest form of our civil program, we had a very wide swath of civil areas that we were talking about and addressing. And in terms of following our clients' needs, as somebody who is a prison abolitionist and as somebody who came up understanding the massive expansion of police violence that has occurred at every point in my lifetime, and seeing the way that police target and harass and destroy communities in New York, the primary fight to me at the time that we first started this office was around policing. And the truth is that in Kansas and in Lawrence, Kansas, the police are not the single greatest force that are oppressing and immiserating the community here, right? That is not the primary cause of suffering here. The primary cause of suffering in Lawrence and the primary oppressors are corporate landlords. This is not to say that the criminal legal system is not with flaws that our clients see every day. But in terms of the needs that have driven the development of the office,
sure,
it is the unaffordability of housing. It is the landlords who are creating pretextual reasons to force somebody out. It is the private equity that has bought up every single trailer park in this community and that sees those low-income housing as a commodity, as a share investment. We looked into where some of our clients' money was going when they pay rent, and it goes into a pension fund in Texas. And when we look at the needs of our clients, the need for legal protection, not just for people who are facing evictions, but who are facing a huge, frankly, unbelievable level of criminality and fraud from especially large corporate private equity driven landlords, is the most urgent need. And so that is where we have devoted our resources and are aiming to expand to meet the need of this community. And if the answer then to the holistic model of defense is that working class people are being oppressed across a huge variety of vectors, depending on their identities, on the basis of racism, on the basis of being an oppressed gender, on the basis of being trans or queer, on the basis of being poor. And there are a huge number of systems that attack our clients on all sides. And the holistic model of defense is taking those needs, and at every point where there is someone oppressing or taking advantage of or immiserating our clients, we have an attorney or an advocate there to stop that from happening. And it is driven by the needs of our clients and the needs of our communities. And the limitation is on our ability to fund it.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed the tenant landlord stuff, and it was one of those, like, it just felt so specific. I figured that there was something to that. If you want to share any of that too, in a way that makes sense.
Well, yeah. One shocking situation. I did get the consent from the client to share this story, although I won't share his name.
Of course.
But he had been living in a trailer here in Lawrence for upwards of 20 years. A frail old man. He had been a carpenter, and you know, when I had my arm around him after we won his trial, he just felt like a pack of bones. And this was actually somebody that had filed their own answer in the case, and so we had not initially met with him because he had come to the court appearance. And we
kind of step back real quick, just because, and what's nice about me being in this position is I'm the rube. So if anyone, so if I have questions, something. So he was being evicted. He was just sent a letter, evicted for reason or just like.
Well, so this is where it gets insane.
Of course.
So how he ended up coming to us is we had not initially met with him. We thought we were at capacity. And after I met with him, I told our eviction attorney, I'm going to take on this case because we have to do this. And he had been issued a variety of letters by the landlord saying, first, we want to kick you out because we think that you are involved in drug activity or there are too many homeless people around. This location was very near the Pallet Village where unhoused people are being sheltered. He's living in a trailer park across the way from there. And he is Christian and he wanted to help people. And so he would let people come and take a shower or shelter under his porch or have a hobnail in the way that working class people look out for each other.
Right.
The trailer park didn't like that. The trailer park had just been purchased by a private equity company over the summer and put in a bunch of changes. And one of those changes is that they no longer accepted cash payments. This guy had been paying his rent, his lot rent, for where the trailer sits on the lam, same way for 20 years. So he gets on the portal and you go pay through the portal at Walmart. Every month he gets his Social Security and he goes and pays his lot rent. And he always pays it on time, and he saves every single receipt. And the landlord said that he didn't pay. And what had in fact happened was, and we proved this at a trial, that the landlord had stopped accepting his rent payments. And so they sent him a letter saying, you owe us $1,500, you're 3 months behind on rent. That was nonsense. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't true at all. And then they sent him another letter a month later that said a different amount. And all the while, he is trying to go and make the payments that are due, but the landlord had disabled the ability to accept those payments. And then they said, well, you haven't paid us rent, so they filed for an eviction. We, on one day's notice, prepared for the trial and presented all this information to a judge. And ultimately, the judge ruled that the landlord cannot, in good faith, have an eviction for non-payment when they're refusing to accept rent.
Right.
And this is partially based on a court of appeals case, Washburn Apartment South versus Hessian, which we had litigated and set the precedent for. But that was evil. And again, we see this ranges from people being evicted, right? But the much more mundane criminality and fraud that we see is from landlords who withhold someone's security deposit. When you move into a place, you put down a security deposit for 1 month's rent, maybe it's 50% more if you've got a pet, and you're supposed, the landlord's supposed to hold that money, and then you get that money back when you give them back the keys, so long as the apartment is not damaged beyond ordinary wear and care, right? Mm-hmm. And there's ordinary wear that happens to any sort of a apartment, especially if you paint it with the cheapest paint, the landlord special, right?
Oh, I'm familiar.
That horrible white paint, it comes off, it flecks. Carpets get dirty when you walk on them with outside feet, which is all that you walk on carpets with.
Hmm.
Carpets need replacing. And what we see over and over is landlords charging their tenants either for these ordinary wear and tear or inflating it thousands and thousands of dollars, sometimes gut renoing the entire place, mm-hmm. and then passing the costs on to the tenant.
Well, until you have, they have every ability, you could make a renovation, but you can't pretend that it was necessitated by the restaurants.
It's fraud to say, yeah, you caused this damage that they didn't cause this damage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think, what? How do they keep getting away with this? And, you know, it's sort of like in Yellowstone, they hunted out all the wolves. And when they hunted out all the wolves, the ecosystem got all messed up, right? There's too many deer. The ecosystem gets destroyed. They put the wolves back a few years ago, and they found that areas of the ecosystem that they didn't expect to see new life in were coming back to life, right? And the lawyers are what checks some of these horrible abuses by businesses. But the private legal market is simply they're just not suing about it. And I don't know why, have some suspicions, but until we started taking these cases, there was no one who was going to bring this in front of a judge or a jury and stand up for the rights of our clients. And these landlords continue to make billions of dollars scamming their clients. And we only know that this is happening often because there's an eviction that happens that we get involved in. We prioritize keeping people housed and focused on evictions, but the need is there,
yeah,
for someone to hold these landlords accountable.
I felt yourself avoid tangent rant, and I know that very well for myself, who has some tangent rants in the back pocket. So I don't want to get you totally off kilter, but
I'm guessing that there's not a lot of money in this type of law. And I'm curious at what rate tenants were soliciting legal help anyway.
Part of the problem is that the amounts of money here are so low that you would easily spend the money on an attorney working on it for 2 hours, right? And so the money that the person gets, if it's just going to be paid entirely to somebody else, the biggest problem is that in many states that have laws that somewhat make sense, there's a Consumer Protection Act that pays for attorney's fees if you win when there is some kind of fraud by a business, right?
Yeah, which is a high bar. I mean, fraud is a pretty, in this context. Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay.
I mean, in the consumer protection, don't get me wrong, it's hard to find a consumer protection attorney, but at least the Kansas Consumer Protection Act does allow for attorney's fees and punitive damages that make it economically viable for people outside of the landlord-tenant context to get this. But there's a case called Chelsea Plaza from the 1970s in which the Kansas Supreme Court said that the protections of the Kansas Consumer Protection Act do not apply to landlord-tenant cases. And as a result of that, if you have a business that is defrauding its customers in any other context, it's much easier to find an attorney because that attorney can get paid out of winning the case. But that is foreclosed for landlord-tenant. And as a result, almost none of these cases go to trial. We've had the first landlord-tenant jury trial that we were able to find in the last 20 years that we had won. And there is so little law on what should happen of these cases at trial that there is no pattern jury instruction. So almost any other kind of case you do, you have pattern jury instructions where the judge says, in all of these cases, in a theft case, we instruct the jury that these are the elements and whatnot, right?
Sure.
And they just pick it out of the list and it's all written up. There's nothing like that in landlord-tenant because none of that is being litigated.
In bench trials either? Is the jury trial the super unique piece of it?
Well, the jury trial is the thing that makes the instructions happen.
Yes, quite right.
But yeah, even with bench trials for the substantive issues where people actually have attorneys, it's pretty rare.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like such a byproduct of this system that I'm sure you have thoughts about.
The impetus that is put on the individual. We have this machine that just chews and churns, and it takes such an outsized effort by those now being sucked into that system to try to defend against that. And I realize that that's not a question. I don't want to volley it up to you because I feel like you could take it.
Yeah, the burdens that are put on people as part of the system. I mean, so much of what we often do for our clients is helping them jump through all of the hoops that are necessary just to resolve a criminal case. You know, there's a lot that is said about things like diversion programs. And the legal system loves to say, look, we are saving people, we're being generous and gentle by having diversion for them. But those diversions are so difficult to complete. They require, in this county, in almost every case, 40 hours of community service, which means that our clients, often the most marginalized in our community, who are often disabled, poor, or in need of services, have to spend their time providing those services at some nonprofit to somebody else. And in order to even be allowed to do the community service, you have to go to the office. But the office is only open on Tuesdays. And if you can't get there on a Tuesday, then you have to call them and wait for them to call you back on the phone that you might not even have to schedule the appointment to get the paperwork so that you could then even begin on your 40 hours of community service.
Yes, right. You're 10 hours in by that point or whatever.
Right, yeah. The ability to access drug treatment that might be necessary as part of the terms of this. You have to complete a domestic violence batterers intervention course as part of these diversions. But there is no provider of those classes in Douglas County. And so at every step of the way, even when the court thinks of itself as giving people a break and a way out, the burdens are such that it is impossible for somebody who is a poor working class person in practice actually to do it without a significant amount of help. Our client advocate, Santiago, is one person who helps people do that. But a lot of what we do is helping break down those barriers and hold people through the immense work that is necessary to apply for benefits, to continue those benefits going, to complete diversion, to complete probation, to see a therapist, let alone to defend yourself against a charge or explain to a judge why you could be relied upon to come back to court without bail, or prove in the way that we are able to prove that their landlord has cut off their ability to make payments. If this fragile old man had to tell the judge himself that that was happening, the judge would think he's schizophrenic and would not take that seriously and would not allow him in every instance some leeway on the rules of evidence that are necessary to push the truth through this tiny little slat in the system that the truth is allowed to go through. And so, yes, there are barriers all across the way for our clients in the legal system. You know, we joke that our job is to be sort of helpful gremlins in the labyrinth, you know? Like, the whole system is a labyrinth, and they're like, oh, it's bad down here. It's like, yes, it's really bad down here, and he hid down here all the time. And they're like, well, I'll find my way out. It's like, okay, but that will eat you, and that will crush you, and that's a dead end. And if you follow me, I can show you the way out, right? Our clients are like, wow, it's horrible. This is unfair. And we say, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is.
Joy's a movement. We need enough of us to all say that at the same time, and then we can make it not suck.
Yes. I do want to say, like, I am a fan of the law. The law is ultimately for people without power, because people with power don't need the laws to oppress you, right?
Mm-hmm.
A landlord doesn't need the law to change the locks on you and call the cops and kick you out, right? The law is truly there to stop the naked exercise of raw power. And so there really are things that our clients can do to benefit their situation through the law. Like, at the end of the day, however they stack the deck, we do have access to a jury of 6 or 12 people who are going to look at the evidence and decide whether or not the police got it right. So on the one hand, we can say, yes, obviously there are these structural disadvantages. There are these huge problems. But the myth of powerlessness is a part of the perpetuation. I want people to know that we do not have a completely corrupt and locked down system. Judges do listen. There are juries who are motivated by facts. There are courts of appeals that actually do follow, in many instances, what the law says. And so the problem isn't just that there is a system in which nothing can be done. It is quite the opposite. We have a system in which there is so much to be done that we don't have enough people to do all of it. But I don't want people to come away thinking that the deck is stacked and the government wins every time, because we are stacking up acquittals. And we're not the only ones doing that. There's hope here.
It sounds like if you put together the fight, that you have a fighting chance.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's not that every time we fight, we win, but you don't win when you don't fight. Again, the problem isn't that there's nothing to be done. It's that we can see so clearly what needs to be done. And there aren't enough lawyers and advocates who are trained and funded and supported to do it.
And that's obviously such a core part of the core part of your mission. I'm curious, do you see expanding access to lawyers and advocates as a short-term fix, a long-term fix? How do you kind of shape that? I feel bad because you just gave a soliloquy about how the system has merits and can work. But
I have to imagine that you have things, if you were given a magic wand, that you would change about the system as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, using power builds power. So we come out of movement. All of public defense comes out of a mass movement. And so we are deeply integrated into the fights by tenants to organize. And if you can win somebody's security deposit back, that is the most powerful political education that there is, because it shows people that they can solve their problems through struggle and through collective action. And so I think the provision of attorneys, and specifically in the lieutenant context, the fight that we're having right now is about a right to counsel for evictions, right? Just by providing attorneys for evictions, we begin to uncover, which we would otherwise not have brought to light, this massive fraud, right? And if we can bring that to light, then a district attorney can look into those things and prosecute them, right? Cities and governments can make different decisions. Communities can decide they care about this. And so I do think just the provision of additional attorneys and advocates acts as that kind of key species in propping up an ecosystem of solutions to problems. But it starts with having somebody who will listen and represent that person that comes with a problem and fighting that up through the legal system. All over Kansas, even in the criminal context, we have a massive shortage of not just public defenders, but of all attorneys. It has gotten so bad that in many cities, there are involuntary appointments of attorneys. So that is to say, the judges are like, look, Johnny Bubatz needs an attorney, and there is no public defender's office, and there is no one on the panel of attorneys who wants to take any more cases. And they say, you random tax lawyer who happens to live here, you're representing him now. And Johnny calls up the number that he was given at the jail that says, this is your lawyer now. And that person says, I don't want to do your case. Sign the plea or don't talk to me, right? And we are not talking about very far-flung places. If you look at the numbers of just attorneys of any kind, right, there are about 600 or 700 in Douglas County. There are two adjoining rural counties that each have fewer than 40 attorneys.
Of any kind. That's
right.
Crazy.
It's crazy. The panel of attorneys that are representing people charged with felonies across the state, more than a third of them are over the age of 65. We no longer live in an economy that is producing sort of small firm attorneys that hang a shingle and take appointed cases. That just simply isn't happening. And so the provision of even basic public defense is getting worse. It's not getting better all across Kansas, as the limited number of panel attorneys who are of widely divergent quality, depending on who you pull in the luck of the draw, even those are going away.
That's so interesting. So I'm assuming that's based on barred attorneys, but we must have a very high volume of people who have attended and graduated law school who then don't practice, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them don't stay in Kansas either. I don't have all the statistics, but, you know, of 80 people who took the February bar exam some years ago, only about 50 of them actually stayed in Kansas. I may be slightly wrong on those numbers, but I'm not wildly wrong on those numbers. A lot of people are not staying in Kansas. If they are, they are going to big law firms and are certainly not moving out west any appreciable distance. Well, I mean, the other factor is just that they are arresting and charging so many more people. So our office was funded and scaled to a world in which there were about 470 misdemeanors filed every year in Douglas County. And that was in 2019.
Yeah. Not a million years ago.
Not a million years ago. Like the best pre-COVID numbers that we've got, right? And we have, in the last year, in 2025, there were about 680 misdemeanors. So a 50% increase. And Douglas County is not alone in that trend of increasing low-level prosecutions. There are a variety of reasons for this. The social fabric is fraying and social services are being cut and people are falling through the cracks. Police budgets continue to increase. There are a huge number of reasons why we see more and more people being arrested on these low-level misdemeanor charges. But counties and governments are going to become increasingly desperate for solutions. And this is not just a Kansas problem. In Maine and in Iowa and in other places without sufficient public defense infrastructure, there are hundreds of thousands of cases being dismissed because there was never an attorney appointed to them. And the person just sat in jail for years and years and years beyond the level of even the permissive constitutional limits of speedy trial without an attorney there. I think as this problem worsens, Douglas County is somewhat unique right now in having an institutional defender office, and especially one that has, you know, started out just solving one issue of misdemeanor representation, but that continues to expand. And I guess the other question is about like the organizing thing. And that is something that we take very seriously as well. So last year, our office hired an organizer, Mariah, who is leading something we're calling KPOP, the Kansas Prisoner Organizing Project. And this comes about because one of the things that we noticed is that there is just a huge lack of organizations for and of people who have been formerly incarcerated or presently have loved ones who are inside. To my mind, all the lawyers in the world are not going to drive changes in the criminal legal system. Where we have seen massive shifts in bail and clemency and prison conditions across the country, we have seen that led by people who are directly impacted, who have skin in the game, and who have loved ones who will never see the sun outside as free people again without a mass movement. And Kansas has none of that infrastructure. We don't have so much as a support group for people who are going through this experience, despite having proportionately a very high percentage of people who are touched by prisons. And so, you know, my partner is a unionist, so I'd been exposed to the methods of the labor movement, what Jay McAlevey calls structure-based organizing, that is not just self-selecting activists and volunteers, but actually having defined structures of people that aren't just activated because they care about the issue, but are talked to by organizers and brought into a fight that they otherwise would not have self-selected into. And so we are putting on our first mass meeting for this project in Topeka, and have also been part of something called the Kansas Second Look Act Coalition, trying to push a bill through that would allow for resentencing, or at least potential reconsideration of resentencing for people serving very long sentences, especially if they were under the age of 25 when they committed the offense, or if they are now 66 or older and will die as aging prisoners that the state will have to care for unless they're released. So all of these organizing efforts that are new and are finally able to deliver on some of the promise, you know, like I became a public defender because I wanted to change the world, and you find out you can't change it just inside the courtroom. So you start organizing, and then there should be funding for public defenders, and then somebody has to do it. And so you start doing the work, and then you find doing the work that your clients have these other problems outside of their criminal case. So you organize around that. And then when you organize around that, you find that then you actually have to start providing eviction defense. And it is, I do sort of feel like our office is coming out of movement and returning to movement and trying to integrate mass movement organizing with advocacy and defense.
Thank you, Sam, and thank you, Jesse, and thank you again to Monica. As you heard, Monica outlined how our punitive probation practices can prevent people from participating in the voting process. For our clients in England, these are real prohibitions that remain in effect until someone pays off their court debts, which could be nearly impossible. We also know that there are a number of other obstacles in place that prevent even more people from voting. Someone who is system impacted may be officially off paper, but they could still be unsure if they're eligible to vote again, and they could be unwilling to even take that chance out of the fear that it could land them back in trouble with the system. Voting is a cornerstone of our democracy, and it's vital that eligible voters are comfortable and successful in making their voice heard. That's why the ACLU of Kansas helps run the Kansas Election Protection Team. It's a free resource designed to help voters if they have questions or run into issues trying to vote. So if you're unsure of your eligibility or if you have questions about navigating the process, you can contact the Election Protection Team at 866-OUR-VOTE. That line is always open, so please call now to give yourself time to ensure that you can vote in the very important August primary, which includes a proposed constitutional amendment that could drastically change the way that we elect judges to our state's highest court. So please don't wait for the fall. If you're not sure if you're eligible and registered to vote, call 866-OUR-VOTE today. If you're listening and you would also like to be part of the Election Protection Team, we would love to have you. If you're listening and you would also like to be part of the Election Protection Team, we would love to have you. We're currently recruiting for volunteers to help us with the program across Kansas by serving as a poll watcher for both the primary and general election. The Election Protection Program has been hugely successful, and we're really looking to expand to more polling locations in more communities, so we need your help. Please consider joining us in protecting voters' rights. You can sign up by going to aclukansas.org/takeaction. Again, that's aclukansas.org/takeaction. It's also accessible in the main menu on our website's homepage. That does it for this month's episode of Marching On. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next month with more conversations with the people at the heart of the civil liberties movement in Kansas. Until next time, keep marching on.